I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Bleeding Kansas wasn't just a figurative term, and if you need proof, just look at Quantrill's raid on Lawrence. This hour, we'll examine the circumstances that led to the famous massacre from the 1861 sacking of Osceola in slave state Missouri to other rising violence of the Civil War. We'll also talk about the legacies of the time, regional tensions, long rivalries, and a sports mascot named for the opposing raiders who crossed into Missouri. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 150 years ago today, William Quantrill and his band of Confederate guerrillas sacked Lawrence. It was a brutal rampage. Most of the businesses were burned to the ground, 185 houses, and 4 hours after it began, some 150 to 200 men and boys were dead. Today, a conversation about what happened that day and what happened before August 21st, 1863, that led to border tensions so strained, so raw, that one historian has called it the worst guerrilla war in American history. And if you don't think those border tensions don't linger to this day, guess again. Our guest today, Diane Mudie Burke, is a professor of history at UMKC. She is also, along with our next guest, co-editor of a brand new collection of pieces on the border war. Its title is Bleeding Kansas, Bleeding Missouri, The Long Civil War on the Border. And Diane, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence this morning is the co-editor, Jonathan Earle, who's also a professor of history. He is at the University of Kansas. And Jonathan, it's been too long. Nice to have you with us today.
It has. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah. 150 years ago today, Quantrill's raid took place. Diane, what time of day did it begin, and what started the whole chain of events here?
Well, it started very early in the morning at daybreak. They had ridden all night, and actually, you know, before that, to get over to Lawrence for this surprise raid, thinking that they would meet some resistance, and of course, they did not.
They had ridden from where? Where did they start?
They had started. They'd started over in Missouri, and they amassed a large band of guerrillas, around 400. They had come from all around this area, and started from, you know, close to here,
including a guy named Frank James, the brother of Jesse James.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. Well, Jonathan, I know this is it must be something of a somber day over in Lawrence, and I know Lawrence had some activities commemorating the attack over the weekend. What's happening today? Is anything sort of marking this moment, I guess, for your town?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Lawrence knows a lot about its history. I've always been really impressed by that. And we started last Sunday with a town commemoration where the names of the dead were read. It was very moving. We sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I talked about history. But today, something quite unique is going on right here. Since 5 in the morning, there have been live tweets of Quantrill's raid that have been going on all morning. I just noticed on my phone before I had to turn it off that Larkin Skaggs, the Missourian who came over and killed several people in Lawrence, has just been killed, so just before 11. And so if anyone on that's listening wants to follow it, it's at hashtag QR1863, and it's trending worldwide.
No kidding. Okay. Well, Jonathan, going back to the raid itself, if I had been standing at the corner of 7th and Massachusetts in what is now downtown Lawrence, that's the location of the Eldridge Hotel, on this day in 1863, just before Quantrill and his gang rode into town, what would I have seen?
I actually got up at that time to start going down to do the live tweeting. It was a beautiful morning with mist in the air. It was August, so there was a lot of humidity, and the town was asleep because the evening before there had been a Lawrence City Band concert that most of the town attended. The first one performed with these new instruments bought by the town. So you would have seen a prosperous, sleepy, you know, Kansas town.
And how far did Lawrence extend just beyond Mass Street back in those days?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the numbered streets that people might know actually had names back then. And really, right where South Park is was the southern the southern tip of town. So it went about as far south as 11th or 12th Street.
And I guess it goes without saying, Jonathan, that the Raiders and William Quantrill himself, they moved into town very, very quickly. Talk to us about that speed and this element of surprise here.
Right. I mean, as Diane said, they expected to meet resistance. And I think this might have gotten these guerrillas kind of whipped up. They really rode into town full blast from the south. Some people rode up Mount Oread, where KU's campus is now, and came down from that direction. Others marched right up Massachusetts Street all the way to the river. And then they kind of broke off in different directions and started pulling people out of their houses and killing anyone. The orders from Quantrill were any man or boy old enough to hold a weapon.
And so if you had been there, describe the chaos, Jonathan.
Yeah, that was what was kind of fun for me to kind of observe and consult with these tweeters. The people really did the research. And, you know, homes were burning. Almost every structure that these guerrillas could make catch fire was lit afire. So people were writing about being choked with smoke, seeing smoldering remains of people on the streets. And again, this is a period of war for our border region. So it's not like people didn't know anything about violence, but this was on a scale almost unimaginable to the townspeople in 1863.
Diane, what do you think that would have been like, you know, that morning, this calm that Jonathan's describing, folks having been at a band concert the night before? How would you – what's your sense of what that would have been like?
Oh, it was horrifying. And there's actually an extensive written record of people reflecting on what happened.
Hello.
That day.
Jonathan, we're here. Are you having trouble hearing? We may have lost Jonathan for a moment.
I'm back.
Okay. Okay, Jonathan. I'm glad you're back. Yeah. Diane, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So there's an extensive record of people reflecting on what happened that day, you know, telling these horrible stories. And, of course, mostly women telling – or many times women telling them of how their husbands were hauled out, how they pled for their lives. It made no difference. You know, women trying to cover the bodies of their loved ones and being, you know, torn away from them. It was horrible.
So is one story that you recall from sort of going through some of that sort of sticks with you a little bit?
Oh, I mean, it was all horrific, but yeah. there were amazing accounts of people who escaped. I mean, sometimes men, you know, literally ran through cornfields in their nightclothes to get
escape.
Away from it. Yes, there's a story
and
of
did some escape.
Some did. Yes, including Jim Lane.
Remind us who Jim Lane is.
Well, he was a senator from Kansas, and he was also a Union commander in the region. He had recruited a regiment of African American soldiers from Kansas, mm-hmm. To fight, and he was very much hated over on the Missouri side. He had a brigade earlier, the so-called Jayhawker Brigade, that was coming over into Missouri on all sorts of raids.
We have a clip from the film Ride with the Devil that I know, Diane, you showed to your students. This is a film that featured Tobey Maguire, came out a number of years ago, that a lot of folks have described as perhaps one of the best depictions of what Quantrill's raid looked like on that horrific morning 150 years ago this morning. This is General Quantrill giving orders about how to proceed in Lawrence.
Make God's work of it, boys. We'll wait for first fire. Head out. I want your boys to be setting up a post on Mount Oread, Washer Road from Fort Leavenworth. Any dirt kicks up, I want word sent down straight away. Here's the death list. We shall cross off every name.
Okay. Gives you a little sense of what might have been happening on this morning. Jonathan, who was William Quantrill? Who was this guy?
He's a very interesting fellow. He is from a state that a lot of our listeners might not guess. He's from Ohio, the great free state of Ohio. And he'd spent time in Lawrence. He was a school teacher here for a term just south of town. He lived in Lawrence, both in a boarding house and then over across the river in what's now North Lawrence.
So he actually lived there, and he still did what he did.
He did, and he knew people here. He had friends here. A lot of people kind of walk up to him during the raid and say, you know, hey, you know, remember me. And it's just one of those things. It's hard to figure out what happened in this young man's head that made him kind of stop being a relatively normal resident of Lawrence, Kansas, and become a guerrilla chieftain, which is really what he was.
How old was he at the time of this, Jonathan?
Oh, in his late 20s. You know, he's a young man. And that's something that I think would help answer some of the questions. There were some hardened guerrillas and fighters and killers among Quantrill's band, but there were mostly just teenage kids, you know, who were excited and following orders and doing stuff that they couldn't believe. It really is. It must have been chilling for the people in Lawrence to see both these hardened guerrillas and these young kids murdering their neighbors.
You know, Diane Mudie Burke, you know, we hear these stories even today of people like the Boston Marathon bombers, mm-hmm. you know, people who were among us and living among us and seemingly living, you know, what appeared to be normal lives with some quotient of happiness attached to them, and yet they turn. What's your theory about Quantrill and why he turned the way he did, given the fact, as Jonathan just said, he actually lived there and lived among all of you once upon a time?
Well, it's hard to know what Quantrill's motivations were, but certainly the other guerrillas, I can maybe answer that a little bit better. You know, many of them, as Jonathan mentioned, were young men. They were the sons, oftentimes, of people who had Southern roots. But when I say that, it's most of the people who came to Missouri came from the Upper South, from places like Kentucky, Virginia. Some of them were slaveholders. Some of them were not. And that's the case with these boys who ended up joining the guerrilla bands. But what had happened in Missouri is that the Union Army had swept into the state from St. Louis in the first year of the war and had tried to in order to keep Missouri in the Union, you know, to keep it from seceding from the Union, they occupied the state. But it was a very fragile occupation because a guerrilla insurgency essentially sprung up really as early as that first summer of the war. And so they, you know, were trying to counter it the entire time. So these boys thought that they were fighting for the cause of their state, and maybe, you know, secondly for the cause of the South. But they thought they were, I think, defending their homes.
Yeah, Jonathan, what's your theory about Quantrill and sort of why he turned the way he turned?
Yeah, I mean, we're still trying to figure that out. There's two things that happened to him that may help answer that question. The first is he goes on a fairly long wagon train trip out to Utah with some Missourians, and there's talk about kind of being converted to the Confederate point of view on that trip. And then he's also accused of some crimes here in Lawrence, one of which was horse thievery, which was kind of a big deal. And he ends up having to flee these charges, and he flees to Missouri. So what happened between his ears, I cannot tell you. I heard Diane last night use the word sociopath. He really became a bona fide sociopath. He reacted violently with people who he didn't even know. And it's really chilling that can happen to somebody who other people earlier described as kind of a nice guy.
You know, Jonathan, as you read through the accounts of what happened on this day in Lawrence, is there a moment or an incident or two that stand out to you that sort of sticks with you when you think of what happened 150 years ago this morning?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really was moving to me as we went through the live tweet is that the mayor of town, George Collimore, ends up running out the back door of his house and jumping into a well, hopefully to be saved. And it ends up he suffocates because of smoke inhalation because they light the house on fire. And then later on that morning, someone who comes in to try to rescue him or get his body, we're not sure, also asphyxiates in that same well. So, you know, you see people who are town leaders who are trying to help other people actually succumbing the same way as people who are shot, you know, between the eyes. It's really moving.
Can the two of you picture it? I mean, I know Lawrence is so different today, Diane. Can you, having spent so much time with this story, can you picture it in your mind, what happened?
Well, it's hard. It's really hard to imagine.
Yeah.
It is hard to imagine. How horrible it would have been that day. You know, I people screaming, crying.
Yeah.
You know, these, I, bodies everywhere.
Yeah. You know, one of the developments that may have led up to this moment is something called Order Number 11. Diane, what was that? And explain its importance in all of this.
Well, that actually came in response to the raid. So, you know, I've described that the Union Army is in the western part of Missouri. I mean, it's really throughout Missouri, but they're trying to maintain some semblance of control over the area and having a very difficult time with it. And they very quickly understood how a guerrilla insurgency works, that the guerrillas can only operate if they're supported by civilians.
Hmm.
And by this point in the war, halfway through the war, most of these households were headed by women. So women and children and elderly people lived in them, and they were supplying the guerrillas, supplying them with food, with clothing, with fodder for their horses, fresh horses. And so the man who had been put in charge of this, what was this newly created district of the border to try to maintain control here, Thomas Ewing, had figured this out. And he had determined that maybe a good idea would be to try to get rid of these guerrilla families, basically. The families.
The supporters.
And so he had done a few things. One thing he did was he arrested a number of female relatives of guerrillas, hoping to sort of, flush them out. If he arrested these women. And they were known supporters of the guerrillas. He put them in a jail, and there were other places that they were taken, but they were put in a jail in downtown Kansas City and in this sort of makeshift jail that was actually a building that belonged to George Caleb Bingham, the famous Missouri artist. And he had an artist studio on the upper floor of this building. And the women were on the second floor, I believe, and somehow the building collapsed. And it was, certainly thought amongst people that supported secession around here and the guerrillas that the Union Army had caused this collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Probably was just an accident. They were moving some walls around in the basement, probably took out a supporting wall. Four women were killed. A number of women were maimed, including sisters of Bloody Bill Anderson, one of the most infamous guerrillas. So that was used as a motivation. Or one of the motivations for the guerrilla raid on for the raid on Lawrence, but also Ewing, right, just days after that, issued a couple of orders where he said that he was going to arrest and evict the rest of these guerrilla supporting households. He was going to arm enslaved men who belonged to secessionists. And that was another thing that really, really aggravated them. So those were the sort of, the motivating factors for moving over on this raid, plus, 2 long years of so-called Jayhawkers coming over into Missouri and raiding and, killing some people and all the rest.
You know, Jonathan, I'm listening to the two of you talk about all this, and you almost can't help but wonder the extent to which these feelings, these incredibly bitter feelings that took place, that were in the blood, in the water, right, 150 years ago, still linger to this day. And I've always thought, you go over to a KU game or to a Columbia to see a Mizzou KU game back in the day when they had them, or football games, and, you'd sense the rivalry that always, to me, not being from this region, always struck me as, boy, there's something else going on here, because people are really jazzed about what's going on in the field in front of them.
Yeah, you and me both. And part of what Diane and I tried to do in this brand new book is talk about how these bitter feelings, this violent feeling and emotion, is translated after the Civil War into kind of we try to preserve these differences between Missourians and Kansans, even though we're essentially exactly the same. The state line today is just a street that you cross, to go to the Burger King on the other side of the street. So really that kind of channeling of this difference into things like the athletic rivalry between MU and KU is a real thing.
And the two of you, you actually have a section, a chapter in the book that talks about just this point, which would be a great time to invite our listeners to chime in here as we talk on this 150th anniversary of the raid of Lawrence, the sacking of Lawrence, Quantrill's raid. To what extent do the tensions still linger on the Missouri-Kansas border today? And given the raw feelings of 150 years ago, how surprised are you by that? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. We're visiting with a couple of history professors, Diane Mudie Burke from UMKC. She's co-editor of Bleeding Kansas, Bleeding Missouri, the long civil war on the border. Jonathan Earle from KU joins her. He's from Kansas Public Radio this morning. He's the other co-editor of this volume. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. And Diane, you point out in the introduction to the book, the men and women on both sides of the border, they spoke the same language, they worshiped the same God, they lived under the same flag, and yet all of this tension going on. To what extent does that tension still linger today in your view?
Well, it does in some ways. And the question is, you know, can you really tie it back to the history? People talk about it that way, and we certainly
can't. You? I mean, it seems to me you can.
Well, we think that you can, but it's again, it's interesting to us because we really are very, very much alike.
Yeah.
We're all Midwesterners. And that we're still perpetuating this this tension that goes way back, and certainly, you know, the events of August 1863 were epic.
Yeah.
And you know, and you had mentioned Order Number 11, and what I didn't end up saying about that is that after the raid, General Ewing issued an order to kick out all the residents of this county and 2.5 counties south of here. It didn't matter their loyalties. If they were supporters of the Union, which there were some, they could move within the military garrison towns in the upper part of the military district. But everybody else was left. And then Kansas troops came in and to make sure that people left, burned a number of houses. And between that and prairie fires that are common this time of the year, the place went up in smoke, basically.
Yeah, and if this sounds anything like total war, which people usually associate with the Shenandoah Valley or with 20th century conflicts, it really was. It was civilians being affected and caught up in war between armies, and it was not pretty.
And Jonathan, when some folks say that the Civil War began here, did begin at Fort Sumter, it began here. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I actually think the Civil War really did begin at Fort Sumter,
but
there are a lot of people.
Yeah.
I know, there's a reason why we call the book "The Long Civil War on the Border," because many of these issues that become the Civil War started in Bleeding Kansas first, where people on the pro-slavery side and the anti-slavery side are shooting at each other. But it's not a society at war. But so too, the Civil War didn't end here in 1865 because Missouri wasn't part of the Confederacy. It wasn't. And I'll put this in quotes, reconstructed like the Southern states, like the Confederate States of America. And you have a lot of these really interesting and some of them very disturbing tendencies, like leading white supremacist newspapers coming out of Lexington. We have an article by one of our contributors about the Lexington Weekly Caucasian. That was the name of the newspaper.
Wow.
You have these Quantrill Raider reunion.
I was going to ask
all
about
the way
that.
Into
I was
the 20th
amazed
century.
By that. Yeah.
And, you know, you can imagine how that felt on my side of the state line when these guys, you know, and Frank James among them, he showed up every year to get feted by his neighbors in Blue Valley or in Independence. It drove people in Lawrence absolutely berserk.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit more later on. You know, I love this line in the book from historian Michael Fellman that describes the hatred so completely that was going on at the time. And Fellman wrote about this about the war. He said this about the war on the Missouri-Kansas border. He writes, "The war became an endless cycle of revenge and revenge and revenge. While using the most brutal and ruthless physical means, men and women victimized one another, lied, dehumanized their enemies, lost all empathy, and retreated into numbness and buried their consciences behind a high, hard wall of utter antipathy." I mean, given that, again, what a great line. And given that kind of sentiment, you just wonder, you can't help but wonder why so much bitterness still lingers today. Let me go to some phone calls here. Lots of folks want to talk about the border war, Quantrill's raid 150 years ago today. Let's go to Scott from Overland Park. Scott, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the good program.
Sure.
Just a comment. One of the professors comment about how people were used to war in response to your question, why was it so horrible, the massacre in Lawrence? But it was the scale of the massacre that was so horrible. But I would say it's important to understand that it wasn't that it was a bigger scale. It was a political attack on a non-military site. The city of Lawrence had no garrison. It was not a military target. It was a political target. And the massacre of Lawrence, in my opinion, was the worst act of domestic terror in U.S. history. Hmm. And it needs to be seen in that context. And it was not a Confederate military or a Missouri military against Kansas. It was a paramilitary marauding bushwhacker gang of psychopaths against a civil city. And that's why I think it's so tragic that it has become a Missouri versus Kansas. As I'm sure you know, most Missourians mustered for Union troops. They were not a Confederate state. So I think if it's in that context, it's better understood.
Diane, you want to comment on what Scott said? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. He is right. Missouri was a Union state. There were, many, many men who fought for the Union on this side of the state line, and many who fought for the Confederacy as well. And then, of course, these guerrillas that were operating locally and were not official Confederate troops, although they had some sanction from the Confederate Army. They realized that they were useful. And he's also right that it was a political target. They hated Lawrence because of Bleeding Kansas days. They would refer to it as it was often referred to as an abolitionist hellhole, is the quote. So they saw it as a target. You know, they used some justifications. There were stolen goods from Missourians over there, various things. There's all indication that this had been thought about for a while, and the trigger was, of course, his jail collapse. But they really wanted to go over there.
Was Lawrence the biggest settlement, biggest town at the time? Do we know?
Leavenworth was much larger, but Leavenworth was more of a pro Missouri port.
Well, yeah, it was a military town.
And a military town. Yeah. No, but Lawrence, I loved what Diane just said. Lawrence was a symbol to a lot of these these folks. I mean, it was the headquarters of the Red Legs, which were a pro Union military kind of militia group. Jim Lane lived here, and Jim Lane, of course, had led the attack on Osceola, Missouri 2 years before. And I like what Scott said a lot. But Lawrence was also a ripe plum for the picking. There were prosperous homes and banks and churches that in this political attack, I'll absolutely admit that he was perfectly right about that, that were there for the plunder. Mm-hmm. So there was plunder involved here as well.
They took a lot of stuff back across the state line.
This will shock no one. Lots of phone calls on this topic of the 150th anniversary of the raid of the sacking of Lawrence. Brian from Lawrence. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Brian.
This has just been really a whole lot of fun. I've actually had the privilege so far of doing General Thomas Ewing, who was the commander of the Department of the Border and was in Leavenworth. Haven't had a whole lot to do with the reenactment so far yet, because most of my stuff was the stuff that led up to it, the general order, not just 11, but 10, which started with not so much the general order 11, which will be coming up in a few days, is the one that...
You're part of the live tweet.
Yes, he's tweeting. Exactly. I was going to say that. Right. Yeah.
And so, but one of the things the fun thing was this one actually started prior to today. This group has been doing things for the last several days, like I say, including General Order 10, which was talking about not so much the depopulating of the counties, but that was the first one of the things that precipitated it, according to the Quantrill people, was detaining and arresting the people that they suspected of aiding the raiders or the bushwhackers, not necessarily forcing everybody out, but they were becoming more of a target at that point, and that was used as one of the reasons that they targeted Kansas as part of the raid.
Right.
And what's been really kind of fun is to see everybody kind of buy in on this. It's been really kind of fun to see everybody kind of pull together. I was there this morning at about 6 o'clock when the true timeline kicked off, and there were about two dozen of us there, and just to see it kind of all kind of happen and experience that way was really kind of interesting, a lot of fun.
All right, Brian, good to have you. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about the sacking of Lawrence 150 years ago today, the raid of William Quantrill, along with Frank James, was with him that day. Two great guests today, Diane Muti Burke, Jonathan Earl, both history professors. Their book, Bleeding Kansas, Bleeding Missouri, The Long Civil War on the Border. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. That's some more sound from the movie Ride with the Devil about what it might have sounded like 150 years ago today as Lawrence was sacked by William Quantrill and his raiders coming across the border there. Well, again, we're commemorating the 150th anniversary of Quantrill's raid on Lawrence. Diane Muti Burke from UMKC is with us. Jonathan Earl from KU, their new book, they've co-edited together, Bleeding Kansas, Bleeding Missouri, The Long Civil War on the Border. Lots of folks want to get into our conversation here today. Let's go back to some phone calls here and go to Paul from Overland Park. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. My great-great-grandfather was Obadiah Smith, who was a farmer in Cedar County, Missouri, and he's credited in some sources as leading Jim Lane and the Jayhawkers into Osceola for the raid. Later, Quantrill says that Lawrence was in retaliation for Osceola, and I just wonder if your guests have anything to say about that.
Okay. Diane or Jonathan? Yeah, Diane, go ahead.
Well, that's certainly one of the justifications that they used, that they had come in to the town really early in the war and had burned it to the ground and displaced all the people there. That was certainly by people on the Missouri side seen as an atrocity when Lane and his so-called Jayhawkers came over. That and many other things, because there were a series of raids that occurred, maybe not quite as large as that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I love what you said, Diane. I mean, one thing that we know is that people said, yes, this was in retaliation for the sacking of Osceola. But I would go back to Scott's earlier point, the first caller, that when the Jayhawkers went into Osceola, they looted the courthouse, they burned some buildings, and there was some loss of life. But it was not on a proportional scale with Quantrill's raid in Lawrence.
Well, just hearing that sound from Ride with the Devil, boy, it does give you a little sense of what this morning might have been like. Jonathan, I'm gathering it's now 11:40 in the morning that 150 years ago, Quantrill's work was long over.
Oh, he and his raiders had already left town, and Jim Lane, who we've discussed quite a bit, was in hot pursuit, along with some other folks as well. But most of the all these guys got back to Missouri and safe and sound, except for
Skaggs,
except for poor Larkin Skaggs,
who was bizarrely a
minister who was one of the raiders, and he killed personally several people on the morning of August 21st, and he just overstayed his time in Lawrence a little too long and got dragged behind a horse and riddled with bullets. So one of the young people who went to our book talk last night in Lawrence asked how many raiders died during the raid, and that's the answer, one.
Wow. And what time was the raid over? What time did Quantrill and his men ride out of town?
They're pretty much gone by 9 or 9:15. They're leaving town. Skaggs died about 10 o'clock in the morning. So, right by now, we're talking the raiders are probably down right around where Baldwin City is, or between Lawrence and Baldwin City.
And again, so just one of the raiders is killed, Jonathan. Do I have that
yes.
right?
Yes.
And it gives you a sense of just how much to what extent surprise was on their side here, apparently.
Yeah. We were talking this morning at the live tweet, like, why were people so complacent in Lawrence? Why were they struck by surprise? Part of it is because during the entire summer of 1863, there was kind of an alarm. There were rumors that there was going to be a big raid, and they just didn't ever happen. And so these guys marched right by Union troops on the border. They walked through farms at the early morning. People were out milking their cows, and they saw lots of guys on horses, and no one raised the big alarm.
And if they had in those days, how could word have reached Lawrence before Quantrill did?
Actually, one of the things about the live tweet that I liked, you know, it's a little tricky to prove.
They couldn't tweet back in those days, Jonathan.
Yeah,
they
couldn't tweet.
They
did have telegraphs. but they actually, an Indian named Palath had a fresh horse, and he rode to try to warn the people in Lawrence. He rode 40 miles at full speed the night before the raid to warn Lawrence, and the horse died from under him. He didn't quite make it in time.
Oh, my gosh.
There are all sorts of
You're
dramatic
kidding me.
Near misses.
I've never heard that story before.
Yeah. It's hard to prove whether it happened exactly that way. That's how it gets into many of the records.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's a good story.
Yeah. Paul, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Let's go to Dan from Independence. Dan, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, you guys. Good morning. I think the excitement about your show is just another indication that after 150 years, none of us who were there are still excited about this. It does get passed down. My question was, George Todd was a Jackson County, Cass County guerrilla. I wonder if he was involved in the raid.
George Todd. Anybody?
Does that ring a bell, Diane?
Well, I'm certainly aware of Todd. I think so, but I'm not 100% sure about that, because he was associated with these same guys.
Yeah. Okay.
It's kind of strange. There's a street in Lee's Summit named Todd George Road, and this guy was kind of an infamous character, and I wonder if there's a connection there. Anyway, I wanted to get a shameless plug in for the book that Daniel Woodrell wrote.
Yes.
Which Ride with the Devil was based, and it's called Woe to Live On. And the dialogue in this seems so authentic, and I'm sure that a lot of the characterizations came across in the movie, too. He is a Missouri writer, and he also wrote Winter's Bone.
Yes, Dan, just so you know, he's been on our show before. He's coming back again in just a few weeks to talk about his latest book, just so you know.
His dialogue is rich.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan?
I was going to say, to Dan's point, I mean, I think both Woe to Live On is a really, really nice way to get involved if you don't know the history. And also, I wanted to shine director Ang Lee's shoes a little bit, because Ride with the Devil, I think, does look pretty accurate, and he does a really nice job. There's dozens of Quantrill movies out there. And Steve, your frequent guest Cindy Haynes has lent me plenty of these movies that I've been watching. And a lot of them actually borrow the same footage from the John Wayne movie Dark Command and show about 25 guys riding into town, shooting their guns off. And they kind of use that as the raid.
What's the best movie you've seen on the raid, Jonathan?
Oh, easily Ride with the Devil.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, and it's funny how Hollywood just has been drawn time and time again to this story, which is it's just a brutal and horrible story. But Dark Command, Quantrill's Raiders, you know, it's just – and these are movies that, you know, that really were big hits. Dark Command premiered in Lawrence, and John Wayne and Roy Rogers were here in Lawrence, and they put on a show. And again, in this the same town that suffered the horrible loss in 1863, it kind of surprises me.
Quantrill's Raid on Lawrence is our topic today. The whole border war, all the tensions along the border here. Let's go to Mary Kay from Trumbull, Missouri. Mary Kay, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I live just north of Clay County, but my parents were from just west of St. Joseph, Troy, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And how different the attitudes and political landscape is. If you want to have an office, a county office here, you have to be one party. Just a few miles away in Kansas, you have to be the other party.
Mm-hmm.
This has changed a little bit, but not much. I went to a country school here and was actually made fun of for feeling the way my parents did.
Mm-hmm.
So
Are those differences, do they date back to those days, in your view, Mary Kay?
I think so, because I'm also in a book club in Smithville, and you talk about this, and they say, well, you know, the Union was shooting our people, and yeah, I think so. And my mother, who's passed, and I, too, we always get to work the elections because they couldn't find any Republicans to work in our county. But mm-hmm. it's kind of strange. Just Clay County was always kind of known as Little Dixie.
Yep.
But our county seat of Clinton County is Plattsburgh, which is where you have to be a Democrat to get elected. But they had a Union hospital there, just burned down a little while ago.
Yeah.
So it's still here.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary Kay, great call. Thank you for making it. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
You know, Jonathan Earle, speaking of politics, and of course, I'd like to speak about politics.
Yeah,
you have
me
a
too.
Piece in the book that talks about the importance of Kansas to Abraham Lincoln's political rise. And this really was a little bit new to me. I was really taken by what you wrote here. You write this: to put it bluntly, without Kansas, Abraham Lincoln would never have been president of the United States. Moreover, if not for Kansas, Lincoln would not have just lost the 1860 presidential election. He wouldn't have even have been a candidate or a national political figure. Without Kansas, you write, Abraham Lincoln would have, in all likelihood, remained a crackerjack lawyer, a leading citizen of Springfield, Illinois, and a caring family man. He would have pointed to a single term in Congress as the high point of his political life. Help me understand just how important
yeah.
Kansas was to Abraham Lincoln.
Well, there's two things, Kansas the place and Kansas the idea. And Abraham Lincoln had been left for dead politically after his one term in Congress.
Yeah.
He was doing a pretty good job being a lawyer for railroads in Illinois. But it was the issue of settlement of Kansas, the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, that brought Lincoln back into politics, because he, like many people who became Republicans, thought that Kansas should not be allowed to be a slave state. So he gets on the hustings. He kind of comes back, and he's a very eloquent defender of keeping Kansas free soil. And then actually, it kind of helps him to be a big figure in Illinois. He gets the nomination to run against Stephen Douglas for the Senate seat in 1858, where he has those famous Lincoln-Douglas debates with a national political figure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, what they're arguing about is Kansas. It's 90 minutes of Kansas, the Lecompton Constitution, bogus legislature. It's really quite amazing. And then, as I talk about in that same essay, Lincoln actually comes here in December of 1859 to test the waters, to see if he has what it takes to be a national Republican political figure. And he writes a speech that ends up being the first draft of the big Cooper Union address he gives in New York City,
wow.
which is his coming out on the national stage.
Yeah. So Kansas integral to what he would become then.
Absolutely. What the essay is called is, if I had a choice, I would go to Kansas. If I were a young man trying to make my way in 19th century America. He really thinks Kansas represents the future of the United States.
He spoke in Leavenworth?
Yeah, Leavenworth, Atchison. Actually, we heard about Troy just from the last caller. He gave speeches all up and down that kind of border across the Missouri River in December of 1859. It was a short trip, but it was an important trip.
Yeah, Diane, how did you and Jonathan sort of come together to put out this very good book? I mean, you point out this idea of folks from both sides of the border sort of collaborating together to produce a book like this. Hasn't happened a whole lot. How did it happen for you guys?
Well, it really came from a conversation about just that issue, that we tend to, historians of Kansas and historians of Missouri, we don't tend to talk to one another. I mean, not that we're hostile to one another, but we go to different conferences, we publish in different journals, and we don't really look at the region holistically.
Yeah.
And so we thought that was a shame. We thought that we should get to know one another better. And so we organized a conference that was in two parts, one over at the Hall Center for the Humanities at KU, and then one at the Kansas City Public Library. Both happened in 2011, where
people hung around.
It was outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
There were probably 300 people for Michael Fellman's keynote address, standing room only, and then people came the very next 2 days to listen to all of these academics get up one after another and give scholarly papers about about the border wars. So there's a lot of interest locally in our history, which is wonderful.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org. Let's go to Richard from Independence. Richard, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm coming from the Quantrill side of this. I am the founder of the Quantrill Special Collections Research. It is a project that I've been doing for about 2.5 years now, and it's located at the Benton County Historical Society in Bentonville, Arkansas. It's in Benton County. This is the first public special collections ever put together that's solely on Quantrill and the border wars. It has about 500 to 600 pieces. It has about every book written on Quantrill. It has all sorts of reports, documents. It has little, small museum-type pieces. And this sprung from my interest in Quantrill. I used to be the historian out at Elmwood Cemetery, and there are some of the Quantrill gorillas there, and Isabella Dix, Ralph and Jetta Dix's little baby girl. She grew up, got married, and she's buried out there at Elmwood, too. So Lawrence came from both sides out at Elmwood. But after I was left Elmwood, I stayed really interested in Quantrill and the gorillas and everything. And I used to live in Benton County in northwest Arkansas for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I had stumbled upon a person in Gentry, which is a little small town of about 3,000, coming up here for one of the Quantrill reunions. And I thought, okay, did I really just see that right? So I did research and everything, and I have found out in the counties of Benton, Washington, Carroll, and Madison counties, there are about 8 of the gorillas there. Plus, there are people from the borders up here. There are people from Clay, Platte, Lafayette, Jackson counties in Missouri, from Johnson and Wyandotte in Kansas.
Right.
I just recently found that one of the members of the 1860 Kansas legislature is buried down there in an unmarked grave.
Wow.
I researched and confirmed him being down there.
Yeah, I'm going to have to scoot on here, Richard. I'm glad to know about your resource there. And that brings up, again, Jonathan, this idea of these reunions that were held over the years. And I thought that was just amazing. Were they held every year or just periodically?
Oh, it took a while for this to actually get started. And there's, I think, one of the best essays in the collection that Diane and I have edited is by a Missouri State historian named Jeremy Neely, who really chronicles these reunions and kind of traces them through time and what they represent. They really get started kind of in the later part of the 19th century, and they kind of helped stoke that feeling that I think the previous caller talked about, how there still are these differences. And Steve, you asked the question whether it's from this time or not. It's that transitional period when the people of Western Missouri start, you know, wanting to fête Frank James and talk about, you know, the glorious deeds of Quantrill or Bloody Bill Anderson. And I put glorious in quotation marks, that this really starts to kind of amp up to what we have today.
And they would get together and what, just sit and tell stories, or just like a typical reunion?
There were photographs taken. There was food prepared. There were toasts. It in the pictures, you know, we have one of them in the volume. It's almost bizarre to see these old men who look like cute Civil War veterans, but they're not really Civil War veterans in any way that we think of as Civil War soldiers. They're people who escaped justice.
But their families would come. Local politicians would stop by to give political speeches. It was, like Jonathan said, as if they were just a regular old Civil War regiment.
And one of the raiders, as we mentioned early in the show, was none other than Frank James, the bank robber, a brother of Jesse James. That's a whole lot of notoriety for one man, it seems to me. He definitely got around, didn't he? Did Quantrill himself take part in these reunions? Do we know?
Quantrill was dead. He died in Kentucky in 1865.
Kind of,
and he never did have of a gunshot wound, but he never did have another real success like we're talking about today. And again, I put success in quotation marks. He was not a significant figure They winter down in Texas. They kind of tried to get things going again up in Missouri, but it never came together for them again like it did in 1863.
Well, slowly in those last 2 years of the war, I mean, certainly they pushed the people out of the border, which kind of pushed guerrilla warfare somewhat out of the border, more into central Missouri, other parts of Missouri. But slowly the Union Army started to pick off a lot of these guys, including Bloody Bill Anderson.
Are there a couple of bars, one in Columbia and one in Kansas City, Missouri, that sort of commemorates or even celebrates the raid? Do you guys know about that?
I didn't know about anything in Kansas City until this, I think a relatively new tavern called the Black and Gold Tavern is doing something tonight where they're having someone who writes about Quantrill come and talk, and they're going to, you know, I'm sure, taunt the Jayhawks and talk about – I mean, I saw this guy quoted
Missouri's most decisive victory.
Yeah, victory over Kansas. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I saw that guy quoted over the weekend on the proprietor of the bar, and it's one of those things where I'm sure, you know, he wants to stoke this sports rivalry and sell some beer, but it's also kind of a willful ignorance about what happened 150 years ago.
Well, just a point here, the first football game between Kansas and Missouri was in 1891. About 3,000 people attended, but by 1895, the school's meetings were said to be so intense that Missouri's yearbook said that Missouri and Kansas are rivals in so many things that each would rather defeat the other than gain victories over all the rest of the world. Maybe that's a good way to end our show today. How's that for a line from your book?
Nice.
I want to thank Jonathan Earle and Diana Muddy Burke, the editors of Bleeding Kansas, Bleeding Missouri. They'll be speaking Tuesday, September 3rd at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. You can find more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Diane, Jonathan, so good to have you both. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Steve.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Well, Congress may be in recess, but the issues it's been debating are as hot as ever. Tomorrow on the show, Representatives Emanuel Cleaver and Kevin Yoder join us to talk immigration, sequestration, and the Farm Bill. Plus, Brian McTavish is back with the weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.